In his new book, the scholar Ed Simon says, the legend of the devil's contract is the most provocative, most alluring, most important story ever told. The plot structure goes like this. A person is not satisfied with their lot in life, so they strike a bargain with the devil. They sign over their eternal soul, but while here in mortality, they get in exchange knowledge or power or some great skill. Simon told us this story is important because it's our story. We all compromise our principles at times to get something we crave. So it's relatable, and it's probably why you'll find this plot all over the place. Damn Yankees, Rosemary's Baby, The Little Mermaid. Simon told us about a much earlier version, the Elizabethan tragedy Dr. Faustus by the playwright Christopher Marlowe. He says it opened at the Rose Theater in London, though the original building is now long gone.
The actual ruins of the Rose were discovered when they were building this kind of soulless 1980s skyscraper, this kind of like glass and concrete steel monstrosity that looks like any other building. And when they were laying the foundation of it, they came across the telltale signs that this had been a theater, and they were able to actually find the foundation of the original theater down there. And it's an active archaeological site. But they also do performances there. You kind of go down this anonymous side street in this like dingy part of London, and there's a little door, and you kind of walk down these steps, and you're in this thing that's basically feels like a basement. Kind of this cavernous, musty, kind of humid, dank space. And in the kind of actual ruins of the theater where the stage would have been, actors put on plays from that time period. And I was fascinated to see this space because there had been these legends over the years about the debut performance of Dr. Faust. When Faust premieres, probably in 1593, there was a legend that said the devil himself was in attendance because he wanted to see that he would be fairly portrayed by the playwright. There are other stories that I'm partial to that says the kind of nonsense Latin incantations that the wizard makes while he's on stage, that they actually worked, that they actually conjured demons from hell to appear on the stage. And this story isn't associated with the Rose. It's associated with a, I don't know if a road show is quite the right phrase for it, but it was an appearance outside of London. But they said that when the Latin incantations were uttered, that suddenly there was one more devil on the stage than there were actors playing devils. So when I went to see the play at the Rose, this was kind of in the back of my mind. And I kept on kind of like looking around, thinking about like, you know, not maybe did this happen, but wouldn't it be fascinating if it had? That was one of the gestating points that led ultimately to me writing this book.
You went to where Christopher Marlowe was killed in southeast London, a place called Deptford. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that because it takes you to this walk, sort of takes you to the graveyard. And this is when the contract with the devil starts to bubble up again.
I didn't actually see the place where Marlowe was killed. I mean, I must have been near it since I was in Deptford. But as I recall, Deptford, you know, had a reputation when Marlowe was alive as being kind of a seedy place. And Deptford still kind of had, charmingly, I have to say, a bit of that dissolute kind of griminess in my mind. So I walked around the area and I made my way over to the churchyard where Marlowe is buried. And one of the things that's so interesting is you don't actually know where his grave is. He basically was kind of heaped into a pauper's grave. And for me, when I was in the graveyard, kind of communing with Marlowe, as it were, or when I, for that matter, when I was in the Rose and I was watching the play, I feel a sense of being connected to something that is old and venerable and maybe even a little bit dangerous. It's something that I think goes beyond the literal ways that we can parse those experiences. And so coming out of that kind of depth reaffirmed that this is a topic that's worth writing about, a topic worth analyzing.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ed Simon's book is called Devil's Contract, and he's joining us to talk about it. Christopher Marlowe didn't invent the Faustian bargain. This story has been around a very long time.
I think the first real, genuine kind of Faustian story that takes on the contours of the tale as we know and love it goes back to about the 12th century, really. And it appears in a closet drama by a nun named Rose Githa. She's a German nun. And it's about a historical figure named St. Theophilus of Odana. He was from Asia Minor. He was alive in like the 4th or 5th century. And he supposedly sold his soul to the devil to acquire his ecclesiastical position. And he signs a contract, an actual like sign on the dotted line kind of contract to the devil. He is to be condemned to hell. Eventually, he feels real, real bad about that. Prays to the Virgin Mary. She comes. He has to get the contract back from the devil because the physical contract actually has to be destroyed, which the Virgin Mary then does, freeing him. And he later on gets canonized, which is like a weird thing to begin. Like, you did a really bad thing and realized it was a bad thing. Let's make you a saint. But like, you know, I digress. But that's one of the first real, like, it's obviously a Faustian story, if ever there was one. The association with somebody actually named Faust comes a little bit later. As near as we can tell, there probably was a historical figure named Johann Faust. He was a German occultist, a necromancer. During the Renaissance, there was a tremendous kind of interest in magic, which is interesting because it's so often associated with the Middle Ages, where magic itself wasn't as popular as it would be in the 14, 15, 1600s. And it really was this kind of like Renaissance humanistic practice, this idea that you could use incantation and conjuration to affect the world in some way. And so it was oftentimes associated with people like Cornelius Agrippa and Albertus Magnus and people like this, who were viewed as great intellectuals at the time. But Faust is kind of their like dingy underworld counterpart. And the historical guy was probably like a dime a dozen magician, like the sorts of people who plied their trade in the late 14, early 1500s. It seems like there may have been as many as three people who happened to have that name that got conflated together. But he's one of the figures for whom a disreputable end is often attributed. So he's like pulled apart by demons after a certain point and he's cast into hell. And those sorts of things. There's a lot of anonymous German pamphlets that are called Faust books that are written during this time period. And that's probably what Marlowe used as the basis for his play. So the play comes out in the 1590s, not long after these, like a couple decades after these books are written. And it becomes that sort of inspiration for the Marlowean story. And then Goethe, when he writes his poem, which is also closet drama, a very long closet drama. And the first part comes out in the late 18th century, and the final version comes out in the early 19th. He's actually drawing not from Marlowe, but from the original German sources, which he would have been familiar with in his youth. And Marlowe, the Faust story was always kind of a tale in like low culture to an extent. You know, you'd see it in like Punch and Judy shows and puppet shows and things like that. So it kind of, you know, it wasn't just in these grand literary texts by people like Marlowe and Goethe, but it was always sort of a simmering fairy tale, folk tale kind of thing, whether or not the name Faust was attributed to the character or not.
I think that, like, as I think about what might be deeply behind it, one of the things that occurred to me was just the idea that the Faust character, whoever that might be, their ordinary skill isn't enough, and their ordinary life isn't enough. The sense of they want something more that's masterful. I don't know. Have you thought about that part of it as well?
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's a story basically about dissatisfaction. And it's a story about being self-made or pretending you're self-made, self-fashioning yourself in some ways, right? This is one of the things I say that Faust is a very American story, right?
Yeah.
He's a rugged individualist. He's a bootstrapper. He's self-made in a lot of ways. And there's many, many American permutations of the story. But interestingly enough, I mean, American versions of the story are oftentimes the ones where he wins, right? Where Faust mm-hmm. does trick the devil. It's this very American kind of like plucky frontier story where like through guile and gumption, Yankee ingenuity, like the American tricks the devil.
The devil goes down to Georgia.
I know, which to this day, I'm like, the devil clearly had the better version. He had a backing band of demons, but like he knocks a lot harder than like the Charlie Daniels fiddle solo, which is like whatever, a little hackneyed as far as I'm concerned. But it's a great example, right? It's just kind of like, sometimes I think those stories have a way in which, a lot of times they come out of, you know, if people feel dispossessed or people feel marginalized and you're kind of like telling off this great power, there's something a little, not redemptive necessarily, but rebellious in that. And I think that's some of the appeal there. But there's always like I talk about legends about this guy named Thomas Moulton or the Yankee Faust. And he was supposed mm-hmm. to be a brigadier general in the Revolutionary War. He was from New Hampshire. And afterwards, he sold his soul to the devil if the devil would fill his boots up with gold. And if the devil ran out of gold, he would get to keep his soul. And so Moulton had two holes in the floor and put soulless shoes, boots on the floor. And the devil fills up his like root cellar with all of this gold, which I guess the devil doesn't have infinite gold, but he has like a lot of gold.
Yeah, who knew?
Yeah, and exactly. And Moulton gets to keep all that gold and his soul. But the end of the story is the devil comes back and burns down his house, which is such a like, you know, you figure the devil, like anyone could burn down someone's house. It's a kind of funny ending to the story. But it's also, it's this interesting kind of dark current to the cuteness of like, oh, I'm going to like trick the devil. And it's like, yeah, but you're not really. Like ultimately, he's going to win, even in that circumstance.
So you mentioned something that Jeffrey Burton Russell had said about the Faust character, that it was the most popular, what was it? The most popular character in the history of Western Christian culture, like huge. Why do you think that might be? Because one of the things you mentioned here is that Faust is as far as characters go, he's the most fully human to us.
I think what's so interesting about that supposition, or I guess what I should say, what I think is most accurate about it, is beyond the obvious fact that there are so many permutations of the Faust myth. I could barely get through. I can only scratch the surface of kind of the most notable ones in my book. Mm. But he is a character that I think exists between those other two, between God and the devil. And I think the idea that God and the devil are the most interesting characters in Western Christian literature, to me that seems almost unassailable to an extent, right? I mean, the God of Scripture, as opposed to kind of the very arid, abstract, philosophical God of theologians, is arguably one of the first really dynamic, contradictory characters with a sense of interiority as it develops in ancient literature. I think Satan is a character that sort of develops in tandem over time with the other character is this fascinating kind of mark or balance to the God character. What makes Faust interesting to me is of those three characters, he's the only one that's a human being, right?
Yeah.
And even if we add Christ to that list of characters, and Christ is certainly a fascinating character, you know, Christ is a human being, but he's also God. Whereas Faust is just a guy, right?
Yeah.
No different from any of us in that way. And he's strung between God and the devil. So there's this question of, is he capable of listening to the better angels of his nature and assenting to a sort of redemption? Or is he always going to be pulled by his baser instincts, which he pretends are somehow grand and justified, but are pulling him down into perdition? And I think that Faust, because he's a character that wants certain things that are not really afforded to him and is willing to violate his own beliefs in order to do that which he knows is wrong in order to acquire them. There's something there that speaks to all of us in varying ways, right? And I think fallenness is a very human attribute, which is why I find him to be so incredibly fascinating.
Ed Simon. He's a faculty member in the English department at Carnegie Mellon University. His book is called Devil's Contract, The History of the Faustian Bargain. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about making a deal with the devil. The scholar Ed Simon has a book, A Cultural History of the Faustian Bargain. And as a plot device, you can find signing a contract with Satan all over. Simon says our own willingness to sacrifice principle to get ahead makes this a story that is uncomfortably familiar. His book is called Devil's Contract. So one of the things you write in the book is that the legend of the Faustian bargain is, this is how you put it, which is like you're all out there with this. You say it's the most important story ever told. Now, I get how it might be the most provocative story or one of the most alluring stories, but how is it the most important? Because that's what you say.
Some of that is a little bit of, I think, holding to my self-sabotaging and idiosyncratic belief that it's more important to be interesting than to be correct. So to a certain extent, it's kind of a supposition that I'm trying on there, which is another way of saying I'm not totally convinced of my own argument there either. Sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not. I agree with you. I think it's an alluring story. I think it's a provocative story. I guess the part of me, at least when I wrote that, that feels like it's the most important story ever is precisely because it's a story that is so universally applicable to all of us, in that all of us have betrayed our principles or our friends or our loved ones or whatever at some point to get something that we want, right? And I think that that kernel of the story, that we're always betraying ourselves in some ways, right, is what makes it such an important story, makes it the most important story. I also think that, it's very easy to think of a book like this, if you're not careful, or if I wasn't careful, as being a moralizing sort of book. And I very much don't want it to be that and don't think of it that way. I think that Faust's example is obviously an extreme one. Hopefully most people wouldn't sell their soul to the devil for what he acquires. But we kind of sell ourselves all the time, right? And because we always do that, and all of us always do that to varying degrees, there's something that's understandable and human in that regard. And that brings up that question of forgiveness, that question of redemption. And I think that it's so intimately connected with morality and ethics in a way that still speaks to us after, you know, all of these centuries. And it's such a modern story in a lot of ways. You know, I make the point that he signs a contract after all, right?
Yeah.
I
mean,
this is a story that requires a certain form of the modern world to have existed to even really make sense. And because of that, I think part of it, at least, is among the most important stories ever told.
Well, let's go way back, which you do in the book, to the Nag Hammadi texts, which this is where we find, in some ways, what you describe anyway is the beginnings of the Faust story. And this is in a text, this obscure text that I wanted you to talk about called the Testimony of Truth that's discovered. And this great character, Simon Magus, the arch heretic, and whoever he was, he's become this symbol and this parable. Let's talk – first of all, let's explain sort of the character itself. Simon Magus, who covets this ability to – like he sees real spiritual prophets, that is to say, the apostles of Jesus doing actual miracles, and he wants the same thing, right? He wants that power. So talk about who he is here.
So Simon Magus is this fascinating character. He's, as with most things, when you get back towards like the first century and earlier, obviously there's always this question of, was he a real person? Was he a character that was invented? Were there like five different guys that were all merged together into this one figure or whatever? But he is mentioned in canonical scripture. So he appears in the book of Acts. And that's the story where we hear about how he sees the apostles, notably Peter, who he's oftentimes paired with as kind of an adversary. And after they've, they've been baptized and they are Christians, and they have abilities. They have healing, miraculous abilities. And he wants that. He wants that power. So he kind of cajoles them under duplicitous circumstances into baptizing him. And then he gains magical powers by doing so, which he then uses for his own self-aggrandizement as a wizard, basically, as a necromancer. So it's a weird story, right? Because he's using the rituals and the power of God, of religion, and of quote-unquote right religion, and he's using them in this kind of very Faustian way. Because it implies an odd sort of thing about God and about religious power. If one presume that this is not something that one gains by doing the, again, quote-unquote right thing of being baptized. But he does. He acquires this kind of ability. So there's this—
Well, we should mention, because this is the key point, the deal he makes, the contract he draws up, isn't with the devil, it's with God.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You're right. He's basically signing a contract with the other supernatural entity, right?
Right.
But the result is still very Faustian. He does Faustian things. And Simon is oftentimes seen as kind of the primogenitor of Faust in a lot of ways. He's kind of the origin of the idea of a wizard who gains these otherworldly powers. But again, you're right. It's such an odd, disquieting, uncomfortable thing that it would be a less weird and upsetting story if he just sold his soul to the devil. Incidentally, simony, the sin simony, refers to trying to sell church offices, the ecclesiastical positions. Like, you give me X amount of money and I'll make you a bishop or whatever, which was a big deal in the Middle Ages and, of course, leading into the Reformation. But he kind of endures as this like symbol of corruption and covetousness and power and the use of religion as magic rather than faith, really.
I, the lesson is that Simon has confused magic with faith. So there's the sort of trickery part, and then there's the real part. Does that get to sort of the key of what that story is about? Don't confuse something that's pure and real with something that is frivolous and something you would just use for your own good.
I think that's right, and I think it, but I also think it evidences a kind of ambivalence or discomfort around the difference between faith and magic, because they are, especially in this time period, so often hard to extricate from one another. Huh. I mean, if you think about something like the prohibition on taking the Lord's name in vain, I mean, that's frequently because magic is literally done by using a deity's name. Or you think about Jacob when he wrestles with whether it's an emissary of God, an angel, or whether it's God himself, but when he demands to know the stranger's name and the stranger refuses. I mean, that's directly related to that idea that you can use these supernatural names to compel certain things. And it endures in later magical belief when it comes to demons, because knowing demons' names for somebody like a Faust is absolutely central to being able to have them do things for you. Even as kind of a countercultural undercurrent, that belief in magic endures in some ways, even though it's become further separated from religion as we think of it today.
You mentioned that it's the tension between the divine and the diabolical that animates this particular bargain. And one of the things you say in this part of the book is that whether or not you sell your soul to Satan or to God, you've still sold your soul. What are you getting at with that? And what's the alternative? You've got to sell your soul to someone, or do you?
Well, it's the Bob Dylan lyric is you got to serve somebody, right?
Yeah.
It might be the devil. It might be the Lord. I don't know that there is necessarily an alternative per se.
Yeah.
With that. I think that there is, but I do think that the idea of selling your soul to something, you know, it might be the devil, it might be the Lord, is an acknowledgement of there being something larger than yourself. I think the selling of your soul to the devil is based on the erroneous idea that in some ways there's not something larger than yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's what's always amazing to me about the Faust legend is Faust knows the devil is real, knows is the prince of this world and the king of hell, knows that he has all of these powers to enact infinite and eternal suffering. And he does it for like 30 years of like wealth and magical power, which like, you know, that sounds great, but not worth like an eternity of your soul being burnt forever or something, right?
Yeah.
He does it anyhow. And I think that the irrationality of it is so fascinating because it must be predicated in some part on a belief or an idea or a perception, this erroneous idea that he can somehow trick the devil, right? Or what's that Kris Kristofferson line? I'm just keep quoting folk and country singers when he says, I didn't trick the devil, but I drank his beer for free, right?
Yeah.
This idea that you can like drink the devil's beer for free, which of course you can't. Right. So I think that a deal with the devil is in some sense also a deal, what you think is a deal with yourself, because you think that you have an agency and a sovereignty that exceeds what you really have. Whereas a deal with God is one that is an acknowledgement of a higher power, which means an acknowledgement of your own fallibility, your own weakness. And that's a different sort of thing.
Okay, so let's ratchet this up to another level here for a second, because let's say it's not a human being who's making this deal with the devil or with God for that matter. Let's say this is Jesus in the desert who's doing it, which is what you explore in the book. Jesus, of course, in the desert, being tempted by Satan. This is also interesting. You also described this as one of the most important moments in the New Testament. And there's at least this implication, and this is the thing I think you find important about this story, that there's this implication. You're going to assume, of course, we are, because it's Christ, that he's not going to take the devil up on this. But there's the implication here that he could. He could give in to the temptation and sign the contract. What is it that's important about that? Is it that contingency there?
I think that contingency is crucially important. I suppose you could say that the devil thinks that Christ might take that bargain, whereas Christ knows that he never will, right?
Right.
Although, of course, that's in Kazantzakis' novel, which I read about The Last Temptation of Christ, and then Martin Scorsese's brilliant film adaptation of that. It takes very seriously the fact that in Orthodox, lowercase o and uppercase o, Orthodox Christianity, that Christ is both equally God and equally human. So if the sort of temptations of the devil work on humans, Christ is within that category, right? So there is something that is disturbing there, obviously, about the idea that God himself could be, in some sense, tempted by the devil. But what I argue in my book that's so important about the temptation is that what we're really seeing is a theological argument between the two of them about the nature of power. Yeah. So if people aren't familiar with the story, when Christ is on his pilgrimage into the desert, is kind of like, you know, sojourn, his meditative, torturous sojourn for 40 days in the Negev. The devil appears to him and gives him three different tests, each of which he rejects. But it's one is to turn stones into bread, and that's when, you know, Christ refuses to do that. He tells Christ that he has to throw himself from the top of the temple in Jerusalem and save himself, and Christ refuses to do that. And then finally, he offers him all of the kingdoms of the world if only Christ will bow down before the devil. And I'm paraphrasing these. They come in different orders and different gospels, but that's the basic gist of it. So what's very odd with this story is, if Christ is God, why would the devil offer him the world when he, after all, created the world, right? I mean, it's a kind of like, it's an odd bargain to make. And so what I say is that they're really basically having a conversation, or a debate, I should say, about the nature of power is what they're talking about. And it's a religious debate because they're quoting scripture to one another. And the devil's model of power in this story is really the model of power that all of us believe in to varying degrees, a kind of might makes right. Even if we don't fully think that, we believe that there are values and rights and so on. There's still an acknowledgement that there has to be some sort of muscle behind power for it to have any type of agency, whether you're doing a good or a bad thing, right? Whereas Christ's model of power is much harder to wrap our minds around, much more difficult to understand. It's the kind of power of powerlessness, right? It's the sort of power that once sees enacted whereby a crucifixion, which is after all a degrading and horrible and gruesome way to die, is instead of being a defeat, is reconfigured as a grand triumph, right? So tragedy is kind of turned into this, the greatest story ever told, right? So I think that the kind of argument about the nature of power between the two of them in the desert kind of sums up what is unique and in some ways impossible about Christian ethics, but what makes it regenerative and something that we perhaps try to aspire to, but inevitably fall short, since the rest of us do give in to varying degrees when that contract is offered.
Let me quote you from the book. You write this, you write, "The entire point is that Satan knows that Christ can perform those miracles, but that to compel him to fulfill those requests, he would force God to admit his naked, cynical, authoritarian understanding of power's exercise."
I think it's the sort of, it's interesting when you think about how people who are Machiavellian or people who are cynical or evil or whatever, when they very often will sometimes think that goodness is merely done as a mask for the really gross, awful stuff that everyone wants to do anyhow, right? I mean, yeah. I think that's one of the kind of definitions of evil, is it lacks the empathetic imagination to understand that other people do not share in its own jaundiced view of the world, right? So I think that if there's a failing of Satan here, it's that he kind of just views God or views Christ as being a mirror of the devil, but pretending to not be, right? That's his great failing. He doesn't understand the nature of Christ in this particular moment. And I think that kind of, I think we all have mixtures of the benevolent and malevolent within us, right? But I think that oftentimes in our discourse, you'll see this kind of idea that when people desire to be good, they're only signaling a desire to be good, but they're not actually desiring it. And I think that that's the thing, is that for those who desire something that is more just or more fair or more good or what have you, that is maybe in an incomplete way, maybe in a fallible way, still a genuine desire, right? So the argument between, it's basically an argument between power as a force that should exist to exert good versus that kind of Hobbesian might makes right, very cynical view of power. That's the argument we see being enacted in the story of Christ's temptation in the desert.
Let's talk a little bit about the Brothers Karamazov. There's this interlude, there's this parable in the story.
Yeah.
That really sort of gets it, which I think you're saying really helps break down the temptation moment. And it's it's Christ appearing in Seville during the Spanish Inquisition. And you say what Dostoevsky is conveying here are the ways in which authority, as you put it, shrouds itself in the robes of Christ while actually dismissing the message Like they don't get it at all. Dismissing the message of Jesus and of social justice, of the, you know, gospel of love, all of those kinds of things. Talk a little bit about this particular story and how you see it fitting into the Faustian bargain.
Yeah, so it's such a tremendous, it's one of the great subsections of a novel, if I can put it that way. It's oftentimes published independently, The Grand Inquisitor, and it's a story told between characters within the Brothers Karamazov. But yeah, it basically imagines Christ returning in Seville during the height of the Spanish Inquisition in like the 1400s, and the auto da fes are burning and heretics are being tortured and burnt at the stake. And Christ appears and he begins to do Christ things. You know, he kind of wordlessly enacts miracles. And he brings a dead child back to life and he becomes this symbol of hope and renewal for people. Mm. And the Grand Inquisitor, who's this kind of Torquemada-like character, and obviously an agent of the church, wants none of this. So Christ is arrested and he's brought in chains and into the dungeon. The story is basically the Grand Inquisitor interrogating an ever-silent Christ. And he goes through kind of a permutation of the same temptations that are offered by Satan to Christ in the desert. But what's so interesting in that section is a big part of what the Grand Inquisitor argues. I mean, the Grand Inquisitor, I mean, he's definitely a malevolent character, right? I mean, he's a cleric who is about to execute Christ because he's a challenge to his power. But the arguments that the Grand Inquisitor makes are not entirely unconvincing to the reader to a certain extent. Yeah. He basically says, look, Christ offers people a radical form of love, a radical form of freedom, and most people don't want that. Most people can't live like that. It's too much to ask of them. So we give them order, and we give them direction, and we tell them what to think, and we tell them what to do, and everyone's lives are much easier because of it, right? Like, if you could turn stones into bread and have bread to eat, why wouldn't you, is basically what the Grand Inquisitor's argument is. And Christ, as is the nature of Christ, listens to all of this sort of, you know, quietly, humbly, meekly, and then at the end, he kisses the Grand Inquisitor. That's the only answer he gives the Grand Inquisitor. And there's sort of a shudder that the Grand Inquisitor feels. And it's, you know, kind of like a revulsion, but not exactly, because he lets Christ go. And he says, don't ever come back. So he doesn't kill Christ, is the interesting thing. So there's some sort of seed of the soul in the character. There's something that works on him, something that convinces him on some level. He's clearly not good. This hasn't been an experience of being, you know, rebaptized or something, but there's something that's still intrinsically human within him with that. And one of the things that's so interesting to me too is that Christ doesn't answer like, no, you're wrong because of this or that or whatever. His answer isn't rational. It's not logical. It won't be circumscribed in argument or syllogism. It's something that's very radical and very different. And it's this type of profound love that can't be explained through pragmatism in the same way that the completely pragmatic argument of the Grand Inquisitor can be. And the feeling that we get out of that is that Christ has won this argument, because he has in the story, but we don't know exactly how. And that's sort of the whole point, is that the ethic that we've seen displayed here is something so otherworldly and so different from our grubby, mean, cruel world that we can't totally explain it, but that doesn't mean that it's not real. And it's all the more important maybe because we can't explain it to a certain extent. And I think that's one of the things, is the ethic that Christ preaches in the New Testament is in some ways impossible, right? You know, when we're told to love our enemies, like, I don't do that. Like, that's hard to do, right? When we're told that the last shall be first, like, that's clearly not the case in our world, right? It would be, if your ethic is don't kill people, don't steal, and that's a good ethic to have, those are things that we can kind of like follow in our lives a little bit more. But I think part of the point of the story is the ethic that is preached by Christ is this divine ethic that is impossible for all of us to live all of the time but you get gestures of it, right? Yeah. You get a kiss that changes something in the soul of a man like the Grand Inquisitor. And that maybe that's good enough until Millennium comes, right? Maybe that's just what is needed every so often in our world.
Ed Simon, his new book is Devil's Contract, The History of the Faustian Bargain. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the scholar Ed Simon. We're talking about his new book, Devil's Contract. Let's talk about Giuseppe Tartini and the devil's lick in that story, the violin sonata in G minor. All right, talk about who Giuseppe Tartini is. He has this, he talks about this dream that he has.
Yeah, so there's this great tradition of the Faustian Bargain being associated with musicians, with artists in general, but musicians very specifically.
Yeah.
And I think the first really notable one is Tartini, who's an Italian composer, 18th century, and a violinist. And he claims that he has a dream in which the devil comes to him and plays this melody. And he tries to transcribe it years later and says that he kind of got close, but not exactly. But the Devil's Trill Sonata, as it's oftentimes called, is a tremendously evocative, fascinating, kind of spirited and ghostly song. It's the sort of thing that, like, if the devil didn't write it, you can definitely see why people think that the devil did. And then, you know, Tartini's the first great example of this kind of musical Faustian bargain. But then you have Paganini, who was a little bit later, who was a composer, but also a performer. They used to call him the rubber man because he was so kind of flexible as he played the violin, and I guess kind of alien and strange looking as he moved on stage. And then the great American example is Robert Johnson, the blues man, really not the father of the Delta blues, but probably its exemplar among most people. And he was the one who, according to legend, couldn't play guitar at all, went down to the crossroads somewhere in Mississippi where the devil came out, tuned his guitar, handed it back to him, and suddenly he was the greatest blues guitarist the world had ever known. And it was said that he would be this this kind of musician until the age of 27, when he'd be taken to hell. And of course, Johnson dies at the age of 27. And one of the things that I emphasize in this chapter is, you know, there's certain themes, I think, that emerge throughout the book. And you have that moral theme that is very strong throughout. But in the chapters on the arts, in chapters on film and music and so on, there's a sense in what is... maybe otherworldly about expression, what's otherworldly about art. That when we think about music, which obviously requires talent, hard work, and dedication, and that's what actually made Johnson a great musician, obviously, right? But there is still something slightly mysterious about the nature of inspiration, of where this stuff comes from, right? Of the ecstatic nature of expression. And I think music is maybe where we see it the most obviously. That music acts on us in a way that's not entirely rational, not entirely intellectual. And that's partially why it's so often associated with this legend.
Let me ask you about what you say is sort of the moment right now where, as you put it in the book, we have collectively sold not just our souls, but our entire planet. You know, we traded it for comfort and capital, and this was this contract that we all sort of signed. And you describe this moment as the Faustocene. Talk about this part, this spin on the story that you offer.
Sure. What I argue, and you know, what I try to kind of put into a word with the Faustocene, whether that takes or not, is that because of the interconnection and grandiosity of the systems that we live under today. We are all ethically and morally culpable and interconnected in a way that people in the past might not have been. Where, you know, the computer I wrote this book on has rare earth metals from Africa that were extracted under incredibly exploitative conditions. You know, the clothing I'm wearing was made in a sweatshop somewhere. You know, the food that I'm eating, the gasoline I put in my car, all of that contributes to the environmental calamity that we find ourselves in right now. And one of the things, I'm not writing this I'm trying not to make this argument in a moralizing tone. I'm trying to be very honest and upfront that I and most of us are implicated, because it's impossible not to be part of these systems. Unless you are incredibly wealthy and are able to choose not to be part of it, in which case you're probably implicated in some other more extreme way at some other point, right? I think that Faust in the modern world becomes kind of an operative myth, because it's about how something that is infinitely precious, which is our planet, has been traded in many cases for something that's obviously less significant than our own existence itself. And I don't think that we're all equally culpable in this, I think is a really important thing to point out. One of the things, you know, I very much talk a lot about climate change and environmental catastrophe and those sorts of things. And I go back to this moment in the 1970s, 1980s, when scientists who worked in the fossil fuel industry basically said to their superiors, this is what the burning of fossil fuels does. This is where we will be X number of decades out. And this is what we need to do to prevent that at this moment, at a time when that was still preventable. And instead of enacting any of those things, they basically locked up the research and they put their funds into lobbying and advertising. And I mean, what a prime Faustian bargain that is. I mean, talking about a couple hundred trustees or board members of these corporations who more than willingly went into knowing what the implications were of something like this. And for what? For like a summer home? For beachfront property that won't exist when the oceans flood, you know? So I think that Faust becomes such an important symbol for the 21st century because it speaks so directly to the kind of direness of our situation today.
Well, you ask, how will the devil come to fulfill our contract?
Yeah.
I guess that's the question you leave hanging out there.
It is. And I think that one of the important things to remember, I mean, there are versions of the legend where Faust is able to save himself. And even in Marlowe's version, that's a big question. You know, you have two different versions of the play. You have a version from the 1590s that came out the year he died, and you have a version from 1603, 10 years after he was dead. But one of the big differences is there's a line in the earlier play where it basically says, and I'm paraphrasing, this isn't exactly right, but if Faustus could save himself, and in the later version, it's if Faustus would save himself. And, you know, it's a difference of one letter there, right? But the implication's completely different, because in the latter one, there's this idea that he has the option. He has choice, he has freedom, he has agency. He doesn't do it, he doesn't save himself, but he still could save himself, right? And I think that, you know, asking how the devil will come to collect this time is also asking ourselves, basically, could we or would we, right? Like, can we change how we live our lives? Can we embrace that kind of radical ethic of love? Or are we fated to condemn ourselves? And of course, the jury's still out on that one.
Ed Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
That's Ed Simon. He's a faculty member in the English department at Carnegie Mellon University. His book is Devil's Contract, The History of the Faustian Bargain. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.